the Gospels, many people meet Jesus. And in the story that we're looking at today, two people meet Jesus. And in some ways, these two people are extremely different. Different backgrounds, different situations. Yet, in some ways, they're exactly the same, too. So you can open up to Luke chapter 8, verse 40 through 56. You know, the scripture will be up on the screen, but you can have it there in front of you if you'd like to. The Apostle John in the book of John says at the very beginning that if we were to write down everything that Jesus did while he was on earth, all the miracles that he performed, that there wouldn't be enough books in the entire world to contain them. Now, he's a little bit of hyperbole there, I think, because there's some pretty long books out there. But it's just the idea that Jesus did way more than we actually see in the Gospels. He healed more people, he taught more people, he told more stories. So there was a decision process that went into what to include. And so whenever I see something in the Gospels, where I see a story, I do wonder, why? Why this one? Why these people? Some of them are pretty straightforward because they're so amazing. You know, Jesus feeds 5,000 people. All right, that one's in. Jesus walks on water. That one's in too. Now, this one actually has some pretty incredible portions to it, but it's not only the incredible portions of this story that I think warrant its inclusion in the Gospels. So we can start with verse 40. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him. The man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. So this is the first pair of characters. You have Jairus and his daughter. Now Jairus, we don't know much about him, but you know, he's a synagogue ruler. He's a man of position, of influence, probably of respect as well. He was someone that people in the community would have looked at and said, yes, this is an upstanding member of our community and our society. And he has no qualms about coming before Jesus and interrupting his ministry. I'm not sure if Jesus was in the middle of teaching or anything like that, but he has no qualms about coming to Jesus and asking Jesus to come to his house. So there's some interesting features about this. You know, we don't get many details in the gospel, so pardon a little speculation on my part. I'm not going to try to make any sort of statements that aren't warranted from the details. But if you think about who had issues with Jesus during his ministry on earth, who would you answer? Who normally criticized Jesus? Who had problems with the way he did things? It was usually who? The religious teachers, right? The establishment. Jairus is part of the establishment. So I just wonder if Jairus had been critical of Jesus. Because so many were. So many of the Pharisees and the religious teachers were critical of him. So I just wonder about Jairus. But when your only daughter is dying, you don't care about those things anymore. And so Jairus puts himself in this position. He falls at Jesus' feet. So there's no pretension now. If he was a pretentious man, he might be the humblest man in the world. I don't know. But at this moment, there's none of that because he's desperate. We don't know why his daughter's dying, but she is. And later in the story, you'll see that this was not just some, like, you know, parent being worried for nothing. There was real reason. She's probably on death's door even as he speaks to Jesus. Now, we're told that she's 12. And we don't really hear Jairus speak, but in one of the other versions of this story in the other Gospels, Jairus pleads for Jesus to heal his little daughter. And he uses a word for little that was more used for children, not really 12-year-olds. 12-year-olds, that's kind of passing the threshold to sort of adulthood. Not quite adult, obviously, but getting there. But I don't think in Jairus' mind he sees it that way. You know that parents, as parents, you always see the child in your kid, no matter how old they are. I'm sure if you asked my mom and brought her up there, she'd still see that little blonde boy running around, even though all the hair and the blonde is gone. But she would still see me that way. Like she could see that, you know? And to Jairus, his precious daughter, his little daughter, is dying, and he'll do anything to see her healed. So that's the first pair of characters. So as Jesus was on his way, Jesus goes with him. The crowds almost crushed him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. So this is the second woman. We don't even have her name. Now, that's not actually unusual in the Gospels. They rarely tell us people's names. In fact, Jairus is somewhat of an outlier. We're not told who the leper was. We're not told the centurion's name. We're not told some of the blind people that Jesus healed, or the paralytic who with four friends lowered him into the room. She's sort of this anonymous person. And unlike Jairus, who has no problems sort of interrupting Jesus and falling right at his feet, she's humble and desperate, but a different way. She doesn't want to bring any attention to herself. She doesn't even want to ask Jesus to heal her. And a lot of people in the scriptures ask Jesus to heal them. Or they have advocates who do that. She doesn't seem to have either. Not advocates, and not even a willingness to ask herself. So I wonder, why is that? Okay, we're told that she has a bleeding problem. And it doesn't specify what this is. Now, it's possible it's like a uterine hemorrhage. Whatever the case, this bleeding issue most likely made her unclean in Jewish culture. You know, and this is not just Jewish prejudice. This is actually Mosaic law. God had these commands. And you can read about them in Leviticus. You know, there are all kinds of different commands. And basically, most discharges that come out of people at some level make them unclean. Okay, not all of them, but some. And this woman would have been considered unclean, most likely. So for 12 years, she had been having that problem. And, you know, Mark, it says that she's gone out to all kinds of doctors. Nobody could heal her. So to have this ongoing bleeding issue, which is obviously a severe medical problem, but also she makes her an outcast. She doesn't really have I tend to think that she doesn't really have a place in society. Now, projecting a little bit, if it is a uterine hemorrhage, what else is she unlikely to have? Children. Now, again, the timeline matters here. Is she married? Does she have kids? How old is she? We don't know any of those things. But at the very least, we know there's no one here advocating for her. There's no one saying, Jesus, could you help my mother? Could you help my wife? Could you help my daughter? I tend to think she's a little bit older. Obviously, she's had this problem for 12 years, the same age as Jairus' daughter, coincidentally. I don't think is an accident. But that's her situation. And so to come to Jesus, I wonder if she, first of all, doesn't want to make a scene because she is unclean and because this would have created at least awkwardness, but most likely some people would have complained about her being there or touching him, because in Jewish culture, everything an unclean person touches becomes unclean. Or if you touch something unclean, it makes you unclean. So in a sense, to touch Jesus' hem, in a sense, it makes him unclean. And so I think that's a huge reason why she doesn't want to approach him. But you wonder, what does she think about God? What does she think about how God thinks about her? To have this problem for 12 years, you know, I'm going to guess that she's prayed about it before, that she had asked for healing. I mean, she's here seeking Jesus' help, so I'm sure at least once in her life, and probably way more than that, she's prayed about this. Now, you have to remember that in this day, and even in our day, this is still somewhat true, but in Jesus' day, if something's wrong with you, whose fault is it? Do you blame God? Well, in her day, most likely people blame the person who's suffering. It's your fault. You sinned. Even if it was something that happened before you were born, you sinned in birth. Like, I don't know how, but you sinned. You're sinful. That's why you have this problem. So in her mind, does God love her? Does God care about her? Does she matter to him? I'm not sure that she thinks that she does. And so she just reaches out. It's almost in a way this desperate act, and she believes, but at the same time, it's almost stealing it. And there's also a little bit of superstition at work here. This is a picture of when the Pope came to speak to the House of Representatives. He drank some water. He didn't drink all of it, though. He puts the cup back down. And after he left, this congressman, that guy, took the cup and had all his family come into his office and had them drink from the Pope's cup, drinking the water that had touched the Pope's lips, which I hope the Pope wasn't sick, because then they probably got blessed in a very surprising way. But it's sort of this superstition, and we still have it. You see some televangelists who sell blessed water, blessed handkerchiefs, that, you know, just the material thing itself has now become a source of healing. And Jesus never affirms that. It's always by faith, and he'll affirm that later, what happens to this woman. So there's a little bit of superstition here, but there's a lot of faith, I think. Even if it's a desperate faith, she believes that I don't have to bother Jesus. I just need to touch, I just need a little bit of Jesus. I don't even need all of his attention. I just need a little bit. And probably at the same time, I'm not worth all of his attention. Okay, so that's the woman. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Now, anyone who's walked through Times Square at a crowded time knows the ridiculousness of what Jesus is saying here. If you're walking through Times Square and someone brushes up against your shoulder, do you stop, turn around, and say, "Hey, who touched me?" No, you just walk on. You don't make eye contact with anyone, because that's what we do here, right? But you don't make a big deal of it, unless they stole your wallet or something like that. Maybe then you stop. But generally, you just move on. And the crowd's here for Jesus. This is not a traffic jam because this is Times Square. It's probably just a little town Jesus is in. But what he's responding to is that he has people all around him, pressing against him. Peter's like, "Come on, Jesus, are you kidding me? What do you mean, who touched you? 100 people just could have touched you, and you want to stop and find out who?" Now, if you're Jairus, what are you thinking at this point? Remember, this is a life and death situation. You have no time for this. So you're probably wondering, okay, why is this so important? Why does this matter? Why are we stopping? And look, nobody else in the story seems to know this yet. This woman's been healed. She doesn't need anything else, really, right? She's gotten what she wanted. She's healed. I'm not sure how she knew she was healed, by the way, because, you know, if you have, depending on the bleeding issue, you don't always feel it. But maybe she had, you know, maybe there was some pain associated with it. Or my mom, who had some bleeding issues, I was actually asking her about this yesterday, and they never really found out why she had this. But like, she was just tired all the time. So maybe she just felt a rush of energy, or just like a rush of power. I don't know what she feels, but she's convinced that she's better. She doesn't need anything from Jesus, but he stops and makes a big deal of this, of confronting her. So we have to wonder why that is. Now, the other thing here is some critics or just regular commentators sort of wonder, why does Jesus have to ask who it was? You know, it's a big crowd, but he's the Son of God. Doesn't he know who touched her? So there, you know, people have responded to that in two ways over time. There's the long sort of theological, thorny explanation for that. You know, you look at Philippians 2, and it talks about how Jesus, when he becomes incarnate, when he takes on human flesh, that he empties himself. Kenosis in the Greek. So people have wondered, okay, what does that mean that he emptied himself? Did he give up some of his divine powers so he couldn't do all the stuff that he normally did? And I don't even want to go down that road, to be honest, just because it's too hard. I'm not made for it philosophically, so I can't really go down too far down that road. But I just think that this is not necessarily for Jesus' benefit. These are somewhat rhetorical questions that Jesus is saying, "Who touched me?" He's making this confrontation happen. You know, he knows the answer, but he's giving the woman a chance to actually come and admit that she did this, which in some ways, at first glance, might actually seem cruel, because what was probably her number one concern here is to fly under the radar. And here he is, like, bringing her out in public. So she probably wasn't happy about this. In fact, her response is, "Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched him and how she had been instantly healed. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace.'" And so this woman realizes, okay, has the guilty conscience about this. So she outs herself. She says, "It was me. I touched you. This is why I did it." And it says she came trembling. Why is she trembling for? She's scared. Scared at what Jesus' response is going to be. How is he going to respond? Is he going to be angry? Mad at her? She kind of made him unclean, actually, you know, technically. Does he have to stop and go through all the ceremonial cleansing rituals now? So there, and I just don't think she had probably been sort of a cast out, ostracized person in her culture for so long that it's hard to sort of allow yourself to be brought into the mainstream again. So I think this is a hard thing for her. And, you know, we're not told in the Gospels, but I wonder, how does he look as he's talking to her? Like, what's the expression on his face? Does he look kind of mad? Is he stern? Is it one of those, you know, we always see those pictures of Jesus, he's kind of like zen-like. He has that very, like, calm, sort of almost expressionless expression. He doesn't seem to feel a whole lot. Is he like that? Or is he almost cracking a smile? Like, you know, like when people pretend to be a little bit mad, but they're not really. Because his words to her are so affirming and so life-giving that I just can't believe that at some point he wasn't kind of boiling over with kindness and love. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. And I wonder, when was the last time anyone called her daughter? Like, I don't know if her parents are still alive. You know, and it's funny, like when you're a little kid, it's not just your parents who see you a certain way, it's everybody, right? It's like you come into church and you're a little kid, even people who aren't your parents look at you, oh, you're so cute, they smile at you. And then you start growing up and they smile a little bit less at you. They make less of, I'm not saying they hate you, but you know, they just don't make a big deal out of you anymore. You're not that cute. You're not as cute as you used to be. Then you start getting annoying and oh man, all bets are off, right? But your parents, they always still see, even no matter how defiant or rebellious you might be, your parents still see, and that's what breaks their heart, their child, their baby. And so Jesus is telling her, in a sense, this is how God sees you. You are his daughter. And though maybe you feel like no one has cared for you for years, and again, I don't want to dramatize it to make, you know, make everybody dead in her life that maybe was still alive, but her condition put her in this precarious position. But Jesus is here to remind you that that doesn't matter. That God sees beyond that. Yeah, he cares for you. He never stopped caring for you, and he never forgot about you. You can go in peace. And so Jesus, I think, pushes his confrontation not just to heal her physical condition, which she needed healing, but to heal her spiritual condition, to repair the way that she saw God. Because we can get some really twisted ideas of God, can't we? Sometimes we get it from church. We grow up in a church that's all about the rules and about conforming and about towing the line. And if you ever step over that line, you are threatened with hell and judgment and brimstone. Maybe you think that God is angry and always waiting to crack the whip and bring down the hammer on you. Or maybe you just feel like you don't matter to God. How could you matter to God? You're not important. It's so easy to transfer the way that other people look at you onto yourself, that other people see you and they see all the flaws and the weaknesses and they get frustrated with you. Sometimes it's hard to imagine that God doesn't see you exactly the same way. And yet, this is a reminder that no, you are always, always created in the image of God. You're known by him, fearfully and wonderfully made. And so he's correcting this woman's spiritual condition as much as he is the physical condition. All right? So again, but back to Jairus. What's Jairus saying? This is all nice and stuff, Jesus. My daughter's dying. And while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter's dead, he said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, don't be afraid. Just believe, and she will be healed. This is not the only time that Jesus makes people wait and somebody dies. If you ever read the Lazarus story, that's a big part of it. Even the disciples are going, Jesus, aren't we going to go heal your friend Lazarus? But Jesus' delay cost this girl her life. And man, if you're Jairus, I don't even know if you have time to be angry at Jesus, to be honest, because you're just so heartbroken. Like, you don't have time for the anger. Maybe he was angry too. You don't even know how emotion manifests itself, right? But Jesus, like, he looks right at Jairus and like, no, I can bring her back. You just have to believe. And I wonder what the rest of the walk felt like. That'd be the longest walk ever. I don't know how much hope Jairus found. Up till this point, Jesus hasn't raised me from the dead, I don't believe. We have a few instances of him raising the dead. This is one. Another, he raised a widowed son, he raised Lazarus, and of course his ultimate was raising himself from the dead. However you want to parse that theologically, but so all those people are resurrected, right? So I think this is the first one. Sometimes it's hard with the gospel chronology to figure out when things happen. So he's really pushing Jairus. This is more than just you can heal lepers, you can heal blind people. This is you can bring someone back from the dead. When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She's not dead, but asleep." So Jesus does this very much on the quiet. He just brings a few disciples in with him and just the child's parents. Now already you see a crowd of people gathered around, right? And in Jewish culture, mourning was a big deal. And mourning in a very public sense. In fact, they did have professional mourners, people who were paid to cry. I don't know that these people who were mourning were them, but the idea of professional mourners makes sense when you look at their response. When Jesus says, she's not dead, she's just asleep, they laugh at him. So if you're here mourning this, you know, dearly loved child or person who you cared about, are you going to be laughing in that moment? That response always struck me as odd. So maybe these people were just professional, or maybe that's just the human nature. Like, what Jesus says is ridiculous. They knew she was dead. Of course, death in the old days wasn't always a done deal. In fact, that's why in some cemeteries, and I'm not sure when they stopped doing this, but they would have the bell, you know, so they would tie a little rope around your finger, and they would tie it to a bell above grounds, just in case you came back to life, you could ring the bell, because there were some issues sometimes. And even other countries, it still happens. But the idea that Jesus could bring someone back to life is just so laughable to them. They just can't help themselves, I guess. But Jesus takes her by the hand and says, "My child, get up." Oh, he makes this look so easy. We're so conditioned to these stories. Sometimes the awe is taken out of it for us, right? And plus, we're not seeing it with our own eyes, so that kind of changes things too. But this woman had fallen beyond the thickest wall that we have as human beings, so we can't reach people, death. And Jesus just brings her back like it's nothing. Just get up. Come on, wake up. Time to get up. Like he's getting her up for school in the morning. That's it. And she's restored. And it almost tells you a little bit how God sees death. She's not dead, she's asleep. Like, you know, death, what is death to God? What is death to the one who owns life? Just asleep. Not permanent, it's not final. None of those things. Now, Jesus, the last thing, he tells them, don't tell anybody. Now, this is a pretty common Jesus thing to do. He does something amazing. Don't tell anybody about this, which in this case is a little bit hard to keep this kind of under wraps because people knew she was dead. Now they're going to see her come back to life. That kind of warrants somewhat of an explanation, right? But Jesus says these things because when people boasted about his works, the crowds became fiercer, thicker, and it almost became hard for him to even travel anywhere. So the more the crowds intensify, the more he kind of has to like go on the outskirts of things. So he does have reasons for this stuff. And I don't think Jesus, his number one aim is not to be a miracle worker. I mean, he's just going to set up shop and charge money for this and just have people come in. I mean, people sell blessed handkerchiefs. Like, how much money could Jesus have made, right? Never does that. Because his primary interest was to reveal God to people. Because that's the lasting thing. This woman who's healed from bleeding, she's going to die. Jairus' daughter, who's raised to life, she dies eventually. I don't know after how many years. Maybe she has a long and happy life, but she still dies. See, our problems with humans, the number one issue is not the physical stuff. As much as that distracts and grabs our attention, the most important thing is always the spiritual stuff. And Jesus came for a much bigger reason than just to save some people from temporary conditions. He came to bring everlasting life. So always remember that when you look at Jesus, his story and how it unfolds. The miracles authenticate who he is. They reveal about him. His heart, yes, but also his power and ultimately his identity. Because Jesus doesn't go around saying, you know what, I'm the Son of God, you should worship me. Never does that, really. He kind of hints at it, but really he points to the things that he does. In fact, John the Baptist, after he's in prison, he sends some representatives, some disciples out to question who Jesus is. You know, are you the one we expected? Are you the Messiah? Or should we expect someone else? And what does Jesus say? Not, yep, I am. So go tell John that. Then he goes, go back and tell them what you see. You know, the blind can see. The deaf can hear. The lame can walk. Go tell John that. It's almost like an invitation to believe rather than saying, you must believe me. Which is, you know, we have a lot of people in our world who claim to be Jesus. I don't know if you know that. You can Google it. It's actually kind of funny. Like, there's this Russian guy on a scooter. Or is it a Brazilian guy on a scooter? I don't know who rides the scooter. But this is, he looks like Jesus. I mean, like how Jesus looks in the paintings. And he claims to be Jesus. And people kind of follow him, believe him. All these false messiahs, you know what they say all the time? I'm Jesus. I'm the Messiah. They claim that stuff all the time. You know who didn't claim it all the time? The real one. That's kind of how things work, right? So what do we do with this story? Is it just for us to say, yeah, Jesus is really awesome. Wow. No, I think it's more than that. Because this is a story ultimately about two daughters. It doesn't seem that way at first, but it really that's what it is. Two precious, loved, and adored daughters. One that everyone would have recognized, Jairus' sick daughter. But also this woman that the rest of society had forgotten. An inconvenient footnote for their lives. Jesus loves them both. See, in some ways, they're very different. Jairus' daughter has advocates. She has standing. She has a place in the world. I don't think this woman who had the bleeding issue, I keep calling her that, I hate calling her that, I don't know what else to call her, the woman who Jesus healed. She doesn't have that standing. She's forgotten. But they're both loved and seen as daughters of God. So, I don't know how long ago, 10 years ago this was, we took the kids on this trip. It's called work camp, which makes it sound horrible, right? Some of you know what work camp is, so you know it's not that bad. But we took these kids to this church upstate and a whole bunch of other youth groups from different places. I think there was somebody from California there. Matt kept calling him California. Of course, Matt could have been mistaken. But anyway, we had all these people who came to serve. And basically, we split them up into groups and we go out into the community. I mean, it wasn't like we were in the most impoverished community in the world. It was just this random upstate community. They do these things all over the country. And so we go out and we start serving these places. And my group went to a nursing home. And I've been to nursing homes before, so I kind of knew the drill a little bit. And so we did some stuff while we were there. I think we played bingo, of course, because that's what you do when you go to a nursing home. And I think we did some weeding or some painting maybe or some, you know, small stuff to help spruce up the place. But mostly we just kind of hung out with the residents. We didn't always get a lot of guidance as far as what we were supposed to do. Now, there was another adult with me, and he was a worship leader. So I think he came up with the idea, why don't we go caroling? Maybe it was one of the kids who came up with it. So it wasn't Christmas, it was July. We didn't sing Christmas songs. But we went door to door to anyone who wanted, and we just sang songs to them in their room, like worship songs. And thankfully, this guy was good on music. Otherwise, me coming to your room to sing you worship songs probably falls under another category than like, ooh, that's really awesome. More like punishment. But we went here, and I remember being in one lady's room, and she's just sort of your quintessential, you know, nursing home resident, right? White, curly hair, glasses. Honestly, I don't remember her name. It's been a long time. And I just remember as we sang, she sits on the bed. It's not her. I just found that on Google, just in case you're wondering. But she's sitting in her room, and she has that looking out the window as we sang, you know, and it just made me wonder, what's she thinking right now? And I just sort of had this idea that all the years of her life were passing in front of her. You know, we see folks like that in a certain light, you know, kind of past their prime in a sense. You know, we won't say the stuff that we think a lot, but they're hard for us because we don't always know what to do with people in these population groups who need a lot of care and are very hard to care for, very exhausting to care for. But as, you know, I was watching her, all of a sudden I had this idea that she was God's child, that God saw her that way. I don't know where it came from. Maybe it's because I was imagining her, thinking about her, even going back to her childhood and I mean, this woman lived like most of half, more than half her life before I even darkened the doors of this world, right? But she was loved and cared for, and God saw her. Still, she was his daughter. And I'm sure no one had called her daughter for a long, long time. But this moment, I realized that's how God saw her. And if I was like a real human being with these things you call emotions, I maybe would have cried, because it was such a moving experience to see her like that. And to realize, wow, this is how God actually sees her. And so that has stayed with me over the years. And so 5 years ago or so, when Cedar Manor called up our church, because they asked us, and they said, hey, we have some people who'd like you to do a Baptist service. Would you guys be willing to come? So I said, yes. I didn't have to think about it much, because I remember that moment. And I'm not saying I'm the world's most compassionate person, because I am not, believe me. And I wasn't burning, I had this burning desire to do a nursing home service, right? I'm a youth pastor, primarily. Kind of outside my demographic, just a little bit. But I couldn't say no, because I remember that's how God thinks about these folks. And so this story is one for us, that we remember that that's how God sees us. That he sees us as his children. It doesn't matter how many years, how much futility has been added to our lives, he still sees beyond that. But the other part of the story is that we should see other people like that, to remember. Because we often see people through this very self-centered, sort of self-focused lens, right? We see who they are to us. But we need to see beyond that. Because there, I bet there are people in your lives, and I don't know who they are. There are certain population groups that tend to fall in these categories. For some, it's socioeconomic groups. For some, it's age. For some, it's racial groups. Like, we have certain prejudices and certain ways that we see people and lock in on them. But this woman's story, who Jesus stopped to make sure that she understood how he really saw her, is instructive to us that we need to do the same thing. As we go through this life, as much as possible, we need to seek God's mercy and grace so that we can see ourselves that way, but that we also see those people that way. And those two things are connected, because it's really hard to see yourself in that sense if you can't see other people like that. And I was reflecting how old I am now. And I was at the Sleepy Hollow graduation on Thursday night, and I was like, wow, it's been 20 years since I graduated high school, 20 years. It's 8 years until my daughter graduates. Amazing. And I realized how old I am. See, who we are keeps changing, and if we look as sort of senior citizens in the state of futility or whatever, when we start aging, we're going to see ourselves the same way. So when we see people only through the lens of who they are on the outside or these sort of things that define them, we define ourselves the same way. So these two things are really connected. So remember how Jesus sees you and allow that to be the grace that sets you free to see other people the same way and to respond as Jesus would. So let's pray. God, I thank you for your grace, for your mercy. I pray that you would lead us to be the people that you want us to be. Help us to respond to your grace and your mercy in such a way that we could see people for who they are in your eyes, and so we could see ourselves the same way, that we would be a church that does that. So we ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.